I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at mofad.org. Have you ever wanted to open a restaurant, launch your own food brand, or dive into the ever-changing world of food media? Well, buckle up. Join us for Aspiration to Action, a special live podcast on Monday, June 3rd at Haven's Kitchen in Manhattan. Zara Tangora and Bretton Scott, hosts of Life's a Banquet, will lead us through tales of the good, the bad, and the transformative. Featuring food world innovators and HRN hosts, Dana Cowan, host of Speaking Broadly, Eli Sussman, host of The Line, along with his brother Max, and Allison Kane, host of In the Sauce, in conversation with Jenny Britton Bauer. Light refreshments will be provided by Paris Gourmet, Wolfer Estate Vineyard, and Tahani. Get your tickets before they sell out by going to heritageradionetwork.org/action.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. This week, we are so excited to welcome back to the show Gabriella Camara, who's talking about her new and first cookbook, which is quite surprising, My Mexico City Kitchen. It is a stunning, gorgeous, beautiful love letter to the food she loves, to the town she loves, Mexico City, and to the dishes that we all love and enjoy. And then, our special envoy, straight from India, Jeet, the man behind the boards, is now in front of the mic, talking to the legendary band, Mother Jane. They talk about their origins, how they came up, and they share a couple of songs with us. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are with Gabriella Camara.
Yes, you got it right.
Yes, welcome back to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you so much.
And we are talking about your new gorgeous cookbook, My Mexico City Kitchen Recipes and Convictions.
Yes.
You've been cooking for years.
Yes.
In Mexico, yes. In the States, all over the world. This is your first cookbook.
It's my first cookbook.
Why was now the time to put out your first cookbook?
Well, I guess it's because cookbooks are very relevant. I mean, because cookbooks are sort of an American thing, and I opened my restaurant in San Francisco, Calaf, 4 years ago, almost. And I think, you know, the insistence from editors and from agents and from just everybody seemed to be the time to do it. I had been working with material on a book about Contramar, and I never really wanted to make a book only on Contramar because I've always considered the recipes from Contramar very sort of normal recipes. I haven't, you know, I don't, it's just, you know, they're just things that I've put together from traditional food or from places that I like and taste. And anyways, I didn't want to make a book about Cala either. So I sort of came together with a book that, you know, put together a book that would offer an American public an accessible way to food, to cook Mexican food and to food in a very direct way and not a stuffy way. And I wanted people to use it, and I didn't want it to only be a precious object of like reminiscent of a place. I wanted it to actually be a restaurant. Not a restaurant cookbook. I wanted it to be a cookbook that people could cook from.
I mean, there's some basic advice in this book that I absolutely love that I think sets the tone for that sentiment where it's not a restaurant cookbook. It's more of an inspirational book, and it comes from your grandmother.
Yes.
And your grandmother says to make something good, it's pay attention, take your time, and respect your resources, which I think is such a fundamental thing to really, a little peek behind the apron,
if you will.
And you use that, I think, an example in one of your most famous recipes, which is the tuna tostada, and you talk about the leeks and taking your time and things like that. But what was it about that sentiment from your grandmother that really set the tone for this book?
I think it's, I mean, for my grandmother, I've learned so many things, and she knows she's a constant inspiration in my life, even though she passed away some years ago. But, you know, and I think to be a perfectionist in a way, that or to just like keep, you know, to seek the possibility of doing things as best you can under the circumstances. And I think that in the book, it's translated into, I guess, a curiosity about doing things in resourceful ways, or I guess you could also translate, you know, it translates in the book also in an influence of not Mexican food that has influenced my Mexican food. And I think that, you know, that is a unique approach to Mexican food that I bring because of her.
Yeah. I mean, part of that influence of Mexican food, that curiosity stems from your childhood. You
yes.
talk about how you were living in Mexico, but your parents weren't really cooking Mexican food. And the woman who sort of lived in the house, Victoria, and the women taught you.
I love that you remember her name.
Because you were so curious and you wanted to make these tortillas to fit in and things like that.
Yeah.
What is it about that curiosity, but then also that tactile learning, like looking at other people, how they do their process? How did that inspire you, and why did you want to share that with people?
I guess because cooking, even though my parents didn't have the time to prepare, you know, sort of fancy meals or very elaborate meals, and we did sometimes, especially on weekends, but for me, food was always a very fun thing. Food was eating was an important part of family life, but in a very, you know, not eating because it was the only time to be together, but just enjoying life and enjoying food was part of enjoying life. And I love to participate in that. I guess I wanted to be a part of that.
And you said it helped you fit in.
No, totally. The cooking, the tortilla part?
Yes.
And that making tortillas helped you fit in with...
I wanted my household to have tortillas, fresh tortillas.
Right.
It was the only household in the Postlan that didn't. I mean, as far as I was concerned.
As far as you're concerned.
Yeah. And I, you know, I'm sure other... Because in Tepoztlán was a town that was full of people that had either retired there or artists who live in there. You know, there was this community of artists, circus artists from Europe and everywhere in the world. And they were like totally kooky and not from there. But everybody in my school, everybody I was in touch with at the school, which was a public school there, really had a life that was completely different from ours. And I guess I also love to make tortillas because I love tortillas.
Who doesn't
because
love
a fresh
tortillas?
Tortilla is exactly, you know, who, like, why would you not want a fresh tortilla? And I think that I've always loved doing things, and I've always loved doing things with my hands. I've loved I love, you know, I'm very practical, and I guess I get that from my grandmother. She's always very like dexterous manually. And I like that. My father had a shop. He still has a shop where he works with wood. I think it's, you know, we like to make things.
I mean, part of what you talk about going to making those things at home is the love.
Uh-huh.
And the caring for others through the food. And you draw a little bit of a distinction through home cooking and restaurant cooking. And saying that home cooking sometimes can beat out restaurant cooking. But... what you draw through in this book is bringing some of that love of that home cooking into the restaurant. How were you able to take that approach to home cooking, which is very different, into these recipes and your restaurants in general?
I guess because I do it with a lot of passion and I really put myself into it. So I turn it into, you know, I really, sorry, I've always said to the staff, we have to receive guests as if they were coming to our house. Like, we have to make this experience an experience of absolute welcoming generosity. And I guess that's what I learned that restaurants didn't always have. Mm. And that's what I wanted to put in the restaurant. I guess that's always been a concern of mine, and I love that you read the book and that you read that. That's what I
figured. If I was going to come talk to you about the book, I should
read
the book.
Very good. Yes, very good. Well done.
But that touches on another part, and bringing it back to the book a little bit, is that sometimes you get these cookbooks from restaurants.
Uh-huh.
And look, I have the French Laundry cookbook on my table.
And it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. It sits on my table.
Yeah.
I've never bought a digital scale and things like that. But you talk about those as like aspirational books.
Uh-huh.
And what this book is really a practical book.
Uh-huh.
And as a source of inspiration, what made you want to translate your recipes for the home chef, but then also give them the freedom to not have to stick to these recipes? Why was that important to you?
Because I feel that food is for everybody, and food, you know, I feel that food is something that one should adapt to one's needs and one's whatever one is living through. And if you have time to make a lengthier meal, great. But if you don't, or if you don't have time to buy every bit of the ingredients that you need for a recipe, I want people to know how to adapt or how to substitute or how to use what they have in their refrigerator or what they bought at the farmer's market or what they, you know. I feel there's so much waste also in this culture of having recipes be just one thing. Mm. I think that it also, I mean, I think, for example, one of the things that you can totally see that has influenced my life is my grandmother's obsession with not wasting food.
None.
She was, you know, she went, my mother was born during the war in Italy. So she went through the hassle of having a one-year-old daughter in those 2 weeks where you had no food in Florence, because it was fine, whatever, we can go into that, but they, in terms of food, they were eating, her father was a very prominent agriculture official, so he, you know, they had food, but there were 2 weeks when they didn't, and it marked my family life forever. it, you know, my grandmother was pregnant with my aunt. My aunt was born without nails because the food was very scarce. And then finally they didn't have it. But she really was obsessed with not wasting anything. And I think it's something that, you know, that has lived through in our family. And for example, my parents' first fight was the zucchini incident, because my father disposed of like two. He argues it was not more than two tablespoons of leftover zucchinis. But when my mother woke up in the morning and wanted to make a frittata with them, they were nowhere. They you know, he just said, "Oh, I ditched them," and she still has a fit every time she thinks about it.
In my house, that's called a shonda. The other thing that you talk about in the book, which I love, is how much time it's taken for you to put these recipes together, mm-hmm. but how many failures you've mm-hmm. gone through as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's very reassuring to crack a book and you see the beautiful photos and, you know, if you've been lucky enough to have some of your signature dishes, to go, oh, these are the end of a very long journey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How do you hope that inspires the people when they're cooking these recipes to cook the recipes again and again and again?
I hope they're written in a way that they can get a bit of the deliciousness that I, you know, that in the end, the recipes, I mean, I hope that with the recipe, they can get to a point where they taste it and say, oh, I want this again, or I could have done this better, or I could have, because I think one of the things that at least my grandmother and my aunts in general, like all the people, all the really good cooks that I know, they are always thinking of what could have been better. And I always, when I cook, and I, this is a problem, like some friends are like, Gabriela, why are you, don't make excuses for yourself, or don't think that it wasn't good, it was delicious. And it's not, I'm not, it's not that I don't have like a good self-esteem, but I'm objective, and I know that, and it's my pleasure to discover what could have been improved, so that the next time I'm motivated, you know, or so that I'm motivated to do it the next time better. And I guess that's the way I live. And for me, food is something that is an ongoing experiment. You don't, this is why I was so adamant about writing a cookbook. I think food or cooking is this, and I always say this, it's like this fine line between tradition and innovation. So I think you have a recipe that you start from, but then from there you can do other things. And if this inspires people to go and do, you know, add other ingredients and they think it's better, you know what? Good for them.
Good for them. We're going to take a quick musical break.
Yes, thank you.
We're going to come back and we're going to talk more about My Mexico City Kitchen with Gabriela here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Texas on a whim to see if I could fit in, and I felt like a proper lady. And before long I met a man, I fell in love, you understand. He was all I could think of. Oh, 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 Stan, you were my first lover. Why'd you say you love me if I meant nothing to you? Why'd you say you love me and then found another? Mm-hmm. I moved to Kansas to move on. I drank whiskey until dawn, but I missed that loving. Oh, I went back to find that man. I found him and goddamn.
Hey.
He was with another. Say my name, 'cause I've been the same to yours ever since you walked out that door. This is what they meant when I heard it said that you can't come home again. I moved back home, settled down, got a job in my hometown, and I felt like a bruised woman. Before long, I began to think that man would be the death of me. So I'm gonna kill him. Oh, Stan, you were my first lover. Why'd you say you love me if I meant nothing to you? Lord, oh, Stan, you were undercover. Why'd you say you love me and then you found another? Lord, oh, Stan, you were my first lover. Why'd you say you love me if I meant nothing to you? Lord, oh, Stan, you were undercover. Why'd you say you love me and then found another?
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I am one of your hosts, Darren Bresnitz. We are here with Gabriella Camara.
Yes. Perfect. Yes, nailed you're it. Getting it. It's better and better.
We're talking about her new cookbook, My Mexico City Kitchen, which I have to say is an absolute love letter to the city. For those who've never been, it's mm-hmm. it's this beautiful, sprawling, wide, gorgeous, diverse landscape, and I feel that everybody has their own perspective on it. What was your unique perspective that you wanted to share in this book that you made sure that people who have visited or maybe never visited understood?
I guess it's what I've wanted to share, through Contramar and my restaurants in Mexico City. I guess what I've done at Gala in San Francisco, in a way, I've wanted to present a part of Mexico City that is fresh and exciting and malleable, or not, you know, or transformable, instead of saying, oh, this is what traditional mole should be, or this is how Mexicans have eaten, and we're only doing, food that has no influence from the New World or from Asia or from, and, you know, food is such a mixture of so many things. And I wanted to show that Mexico City is a very cosmopolitan, rich, culturally more diverse than we think place.
I mean, that gets into the very dicey topic of quote-unquote authenticity, which pops up from time to time in this show. And for those who have experienced Mexico City your way, this feels like a very authentic take on the city itself.
Right.
Do you feel the same way that this book represents an authentic take in like the general sense, or just your authentic take on what Mexico City cuisine is?
I think the term authentic is so difficult and so messy.
We always bring it up with a caveat, but I wanted to get your perspective on it.
Yeah. Authentic also has evolved. You know,
right.
who defines authentic? And I do believe that there, you know, most of the recipes in this cookbook are not traditional Mexican food, or what has been considered traditional Mexican food. I also have an issue with this, but authentic is more the problem, because tradition, you could say, you know, in this town, they've always used this ingredient for this dish. That's a tradition, right? So that's, but to say authentic, or that it isn't authentic if they take out one ingredient. Well, maybe, you know, is it authentic because of the ingredients? Is it authentic because of where it's made? Is it authentic because of who makes it? Is it authentic? I mean, it has, I think, so many exceptions that I think it's authentic in that it is Mexican. It is authentic, you know. Is it a Mexican restaurant because it's in Mexico City? Yeah, I think so. Even if it's Japanese, it's, you know, and it's wanting to be respectful of traditional Japanese methods in cooking or ingredients, it's still a Japanese restaurant in Mexico. And I think then it is a Mexican restaurant, but not, you know, it's tricky. I think, and I've really spent a lot of time trying to define this. I think to be Mexican, basically, you have to, you know, be in Mexico, do it in Mexico, whatever. But to be Mexican abroad is also, you know, has its own nuances, because I do think that to be authentic Mexican, I don't know. I think, I mean, it's really so subjective. And I think we're in a time of life or of the world where the personal becomes very relevant, or we want to give it the importance that it is, which is a totality of somebody, you know, someone's experience. And I think that cooking with elements of a part of the world or a certain geographic determined area will make your restaurant or will make your food from there. But then if you cook it elsewhere and still use those ingredients, it still is that. But so I don't, you know, I don't, I really think that the word authentic is charged with too many things. And I do, I will just tell you, this is a genuine book from somebody, or this is a genuine, you know, these are recipes from places that, in which people have been making their thing. And it's, you know, when I, this is why I wanted to portray recipes from certain places that were my favorite places in Mexico City. Say, the tacos de lengua from Don Juan, this taqueria that opens, that has lengua on Fridays in Condesa. You know, I don't know if it's the best taco de lengua. I love tacos de lengua, however, I guess. I mean, as long as it's good. It's good quality. I love them with chile, you know, with different sauces, with, but in different preparations. But I think the tacos de lengua in salsa verde are pretty authentic Mexican. I mean, you know, it's certainly not a dish from another part of the world. So I would say, you know, with all the layers of complexity, because also Mexico City is a place where people aren't from, but they have come to for centuries. And so they have appropriated, you know, things from different parts of the different regions in Mexico and the different influences of people who have come to Mexico City. So, you know, authentic Mexican, yeah, it is an authentic Mexican cookbook with recipes from there.
I mean, I absolutely love that response. And it's a tricky question, and I love it. And what I love about it is that you do give people a guide. Like, for example, I think in that same set, you talk about a guisado that you love from this one taco spot. And you say, I'm going to only share one guisado recipe with you just to show you the process.
Uh-huh.
Just to give you that, like, base information of how you do it, then take it and make it your own.
Uh-huh.
And I love that you are just letting people, I mean, there's 150 recipes, right? But you're giving people different entry points. So,
yeah, I think it's really important with food
that
people enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I want people to taste something and say, oh, I want more of this, but maybe I could add some salt, or maybe I could take away, you know, maybe I put too much lime. And I want people to learn how to actually enjoy putting ingredients together.
So with this,
and eating them.
With this book, I mean, it's not just the recipes, but there's also essays and beautiful things like that. If I was a beginner, if I'd never made Mexican food, where do I start? And if I feel comfortable with Mexican food, where would I, what would you recommend as like a first entryway into this?
I would recommend that you read it.
Yeah.
And then I think if you do read it, at least if you read the introduction, then you will be more comfortable with saying, oh, I feel like eating potatoes, and then finding a recipe with potatoes.
There's one section I want to talk about before we're out of time, and it's the everything can be a taco.
I know. That has been such a smashing success, I'm very happy to have.
And listen, as someone who keeps not the freshest tortillas in his fridge, there are times when I go, that could go in between a tortilla and that'll be better.
And you do it.
Oh, of course.
Right.
Quietly in the dark with no one looking or judging me.
Yeah.
But I wanted to say, look, we could talk about the spaghetti taco. We could talk about the stuff. But at your heart, why is that section so important to you? What is it trying to really say?
Because it's trying to say that in Mexico, like, if you have good tortillas, or in Mexico, traditionally, and here we do go to traditionally, the tortilla serves the purpose of bread or naan in India, or you know, it was the grain with which you accompany every meal. In Tepoztlán, where I grew up, and I think I mentioned that in the book, people wouldn't use silverware. They used the tortilla to eat. And you know, you need to learn how to eat with a tortilla without being messy.
Right.
And I was very proud to have learned that. My mother, you know, she's from Florence, and my aristocratic Florentine family is very proud of the fact that Caterina de Medici brought silverware, the fork, to France, to Paris, when she, you know, when she married the king, whatever he was. But so the Florentines are very proud of their modern world inventions, quote unquote. And I, you know, my mother, even though she was never going to not eat with a fork and knife, she found it, I think, very not only amusing, but she was very encouraging of my delight in learning how to eat with a tortilla.
I love it. So in addition to the food photos, there's also beautiful photos of Mexico City. These just like gorgeous moments that make it feel like an insider's look or just catching this very candid moment. Why did you want to include those scenes within this book?
Well, first of all, the book was the photography is by Marcus Nielsen, who's a great photographer, and Marcus
stunning,
great.
He's totally
my favorite food photographer, I think, and thankfully we were able to work on this together. But we had worked the previous Contramar book, or the one we were working on, which ended up being more of a, I think we will publish it eventually because it's more of a registry of the people. It's more like a portrait book. But he spent a lot of time in Mexico City, and he went there with James Casey, who was the designer of the book, to make this magazine Swallow.
Oh my God. One of my favorite episodes. Yes. The Scratch and Sniff, yes. Mexico City, yes. One. James, yes. Casey, wherever you, yes, are,
yes.
I love you.
Yes, yes. And, you know, this team, we had, you know, we've been in Mexico City many times for different commissions that Marcus has gotten. We hang out, and you know, Marcus has these great pictures of Mexico City, and many of them were intended for this Contramar book. That has never happened. So we used some of the pictures in this book because I just thought it needed context. I don't want a recipe book that is just like dumbed down Mexican food, you know, like margaritas and tacos. But I also didn't want it to be inaccessible and too precious. I wanted it to be about the city of Mexico being a welcoming city in which you can eat delicious things on the street that you would have never imagined could come out of a street cart, that are as sophisticated as or more than many of the things you eat in restaurants. And Contramar is a restaurant inspired by simple recipes that are delicious but that are not sophisticated or not particularly elaborate recipes. They're just based on incredible ingredients. And this is a very Italian approach to food. So I guess I just wanted to make that very clear in the book. And I wanted to make it clear that it wasn't like a California or Mediterranean approach to Mexican food. It was from Mexico City. So I needed the context of these beautiful shots of this incredible city. And I think that we're actually missing great shots of Mexico City because there's some that are, I mean, I think, you know, and you always, when you make a cookbook, you always, or when you make anything, me, when I make anything, when I make a pot of beans, I'm always thinking of what I could have done better, even if I do enjoy the beans, and I do enjoy the book, and I think it's great. But I, of course, think, you know, we could have put more of these pictures here because it would have given a broader context. Or we, you know, maybe next to the recipe of such and such, it needed a picture. I do believe that cookbooks, for me at least, that I'm very visual. I really appreciate cookbooks that have great pictures that show you what the author is talking about in the recipe. Because for me, to have a visual reference is super important just in terms of understanding what I'm supposed to obtain or to get to. And I wish we could have done that with every recipe.
Well, listen, I'm sure, like all of your friends, I think this is stunning. And
thank
you are
you
looking
so much.
How to make volume 2 even better. If people want to get My Mexico City Kitchen, where can they get it?
I think in like major bookstores or books, food book, cookbook stores, which is thankfully the cookbooks are saving the printed.
they are.
Yeah. But no, they Amazon.
Amazon.
Of
and,
course.
And if people want to follow you online or follow, go to the restaurants, where can they find you?
The restaurants. Okay. So Cala in San Francisco, C-A-L-A. It's on 149 Fell Street between Franklin and Van Ness. And it's really, I'm very proud of Cala. I love it. And then in Contramar and Entremar in Mexico City, Contramar at, what is it?
Contramar.
No, info the, at Contramar.
Yeah, info at yeah. Contramar.
Or reservations yeah. at Contramar. And I am, my Instagram account, even though I'm a terrible social media user, my Instagram, I really do enjoy it, but I'm terrible at posting. I am Gabriela Cámara, just that way.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
We have another song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Yeah, 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 yeah. If I die before I wake, if I die before I wake, my soul to take. If I die before I wake, if I die before I wake, my soul to take. If I die before I wake, if I die before I wake, my soul to take.
These niggas fake. Dave Chappelle, you come and have bait. Austin 316, nigga got big drinks. Mark up the beats. Austin 316, nigga got big drinks. Mark up the beats. Austin 316. Nigga got big dreams. Mark up the beats. Mark up the beats. Mark up the beats. Coming in like
Steph Curry.
If I die before I'm famous,
hope that these niggas stop faking.
Hope that these niggas stop hating.
Hope that these niggas stop
playing.
Hope that these niggas stop
playing.
Six niggas at my wake. Six niggas at the pearly gates. Six niggas not another yay. Six niggas not another yay. Six, 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 six. Got these niggas shaking. Got these niggas shaking. Assalamu alaikum. Mama in the front seat crying, church bells ringing, everybody dying. Fuck what I like, Layama Stott is my black head of light. All these niggas stuck in the middle path. Galaxy Nash, I'ma hit him with the pass. If I die before I wake, if I die before I wake, my soul to take. If I die before I wake, if I die before I wake, my soul to take. If I die before I wake, if I die before I wake, my soul to take.
These niggas fake.
Dave Chappelle, you coming now, babe? But Austin 316, nigga got big dreams. Mark up the beats, Austin 316, nigga got big dreams. Mark up the beats, Austin 316, nigga got big dreams. Mark up the beats, Mark up the beats, Mark up the beats. Coming to my new like Steph Curry.
Wow.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Do you love this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. We have over 35,000 shows in our online library. My name is Jennifer Leuzzi, and I'm the host of Tech Bites, where we talk to innovators and influencers in the food tech space. You can find Tech Bites wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks for listening.
You started the band?
Yeah, right. Yeah, me and a group of friends, you know, at that point, yeah.
In 96.
96,
right. Yes. And you said that there were two drummers in the beginning?
Yeah, we had two drummers, another drummer called Cecil, because Mithun, Laji, Nirmal and Sham, they were already a band without a drummer.
Okay.
And they approached me for a gig, but I was already hooked with another band at that point. So I suggested you guys go with Cecil now for the time being. And then there was no concept of Mother Jane. You know, it's like one gig, one standalone gig. They did it and that's it.
All right.
Then what happened was I was the cultural secretary at that point in my college. So then we had booked a band. And as you know, no budgets for a college. So this band was supposed to play for free. And, you know, I don't know what happened. Some shit happened. And then they backed out like 1 week prior to the concert. So then I had no choice but to get these guys because most of my like juniors in college were like complete metalheads.
Okay.
So they won't tolerate anything but metal. So, you know, so we had to play all these metal hits at that point. So then I called these guys.
Meaning the original.
So these guys. And when we practiced for 1 week and went on stage. And for that gig, we put this name Mother Jane.
Really?
Like, you know, so.
Oh my God.
And I completely hated that name at that point. But
why?
Yeah, because I didn't like it. What stupid name is it? But this guy, one of my friends, and then, you know, he was so adamant, like, you know, you guys should go with this name, you know, you can't change this. And okay, fine. Then we went on stage, we played the gig. And then, you know, we got together. Actually, it was like supposed to be a standalone gig. And then we were supposed to go our own ways. But then we, you know, did one more gig. And then we organized one gig on our own.
Mm-hmm.
So then we thought we'll
keep it going.
And take it ahead, you know, so like that. So that's how it happened.
That's the beginning. That's crazy. Because I think I heard about you when I first came to India around 2003, 2004. That's also the time when you had
we released our first biography record. Yeah,
right.
Correct.
Yeah, it was game changing. I just remember how different the music was, because it was rock, like progressive rock, right, but then all this classical Indian music kind of fused.
Only one track had something like that, which also came by accident because we didn't plan anything Indian in that record. Because you know, but what happened was when we were recording, one session flautist we just came into the console to see what was happening here. Then Baiju was friends with him. He called him, "Hey, why don't you play something? You play whatever." And he did something, and that stuck with the audience. Like, you know, oh shit.
Wow. A flautist?
Yeah.
Really? It wasn't intentionally
Indian? No, it was not at all intentional.
Really?
Because, you know, we never planned any Indian elements in that record. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Because when I hear it, it's very apparent. You know, I don't know if it's because of part of your, you know, DNA culture.
That comes
being
through.
Around,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Because, you know, you are also, so what happens is, because we are constantly exposed to that music, no? And the culture, right. And Indian culture being so deep-rooted.
Right, right.
It will surface at any point, I guess.
I didn't know. At first, I thought the mindset was to be a progressive rock band with Indian style, but it wasn't that.
No, absolutely just, not. Yeah, it just came by accident.
That's so, I didn't even know that. So this is actually fun. I'm learning a lot.
Or it was planned in a pre-birth situation.
Yeah, in a previous life. And so after you formed the initial lineup,
right? Yeah.
When did it start? Like, when did it go from, you know, one gig here, one gig there, to like, okay, actually, let's start writing our own music. Let's start touring and playing shows.
That I should, you know, I should give credit to Suraj for it. Because, you know, then, like any other band in the 90s, we want to play our favorite covers, you know,
right,
to perfection and, you know.
Right, right.
And show off our chops and all that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was the mentality at that point. But then Suraj came up with this idea, like, you know, however you play a cover, another band will come and, like, you know, bowl you over. So, you know, it's pointless. Like
it's still
to,
a cover.
Yeah, it's still a cover. And, you know, you were not going anywhere with that. So, Suraj said, you know, when he cornered us and made us write songs, you know, so then we were like, oh, shit. And then we'll, like, you know, please this guy and to keep this guy in the band.
Right.
Actually, he threatened us to quit the band also.
Really?
So we had to write songs to keep this guy in the band. So then it slowly happened, and it was not slow actually. This Mine Street, one of our favorite
biggest
songs,
hit,
as in with the audience. It was written in like 30 minutes, I guess. You know?
Really?
And the tune, the Vamp, was already one song made by Rex.
Really?
So he used to be a prolific writer or producer, because, you know, he used to write a lot of instrumental tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a lot of instrumental tracks when he came into the band. So this was one of the tracks which had that Vamp, and then we had added more stuff. And
the
then
Vamp
became,
meaning like what? The
that
main?
Tune, that main...
the main
lick,
riff?
No, guitar
really?
Lick, yeah.
So he had already written that.
Yeah, that was already a song that he had an instrumental track.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. So this guy came with it, and then Baiju took it somewhere else, and, you know, then became a song in less than 30 minutes.
Really? Because that was the biggest hit when Insane Biography came out.
To our gig to listen to.
Still, it's the biggest. Really?
Yeah, it kind of.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. I didn't think it would still be the biggest hit, because once it went to Maktub, there's a lot of really good tracks on there.
But Maktub also had another version of Mind Street.
Yeah, I noticed that. I was wondering why the guitars did that muted thing, but that's fine. Yeah, I remember, when was Maktub recorded?
It was done in 2007 to 8 and released in 8.
So 2007 to 2008.
We recorded 3 versions of that record.
Really?
The first one we did again in Cochin, but it was like pathetic, and pathetic would be an understatement.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, this is not going to be released.
Yeah.
So let's. Then I did a recording at Jam, you know, the old Jam.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we did one recording, and the drum sound was best in that recording.
Really?
But again, you know, I worked with another recordist, producer kind of a guy, but I don't know what happened. In the edit, it got so screwed that, you know, after that, you know, it was like here and there, and we worked again, and then we knew that it's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And we recorded all the songs for the third time, and that's what you hear on the
really?
Record.
We were just talking about doing one song.
Yeah.
Oh man, I don't know how you did a full album three times. Because I'm already sick of a song after
Right. That was like persistence, my God.
And this was Gopi Charan, right?
Yeah, but Gopi's studio.
Because I remember my high school band at the time was recording some cover songs like Metallica, Master Puppets.
Okay.
And I remember either it was around that time or a little after, I was starting to get into sound engineering. And so I would call up Gopijan and ask him questions like, hey, how do you use a microphone and how do you do this? And he'll always invite me to his studio and show. And I remember once he invited me and Suraj was recording.
Oh, okay.
And
then
I just...
That was a vocal being recorded,
It was actually for Chasing the Sun. He was recording vocals.
Okay.
And I was very nervous because I didn't know how to react in front of him, because you guys at that point were like huge. And then after Suraj and all left, Gopi played me Maktub, the title track.
I don't know if
it was mixed or not, but at that point I didn't really understand mixed versus unmixed. I just remember really loving that title track song. It's like really interesting.
Thank you.
Just like, I don't know what it was about, because it was a big difference from Insane Biography.
Yeah,
Insane
absolutely.
Biography was like more of like the first kind of attempt at writing music.
And this
sounded like a lot more mature and cohesive, you know, even lyrically. Like, Suraj's lyrics were very powerful.
Yeah. He evolved to a point, and, you know, so...
I take a step in my sleep. It lies bleeding in my street. My angel shot full of holes. Now I know how to get him home. Cause in this world made of meat, rules change with every beat. There's magic in the air. Cause hear God, see your prayer. Come back and dream in my street. Do what you want, go where you please. Keep the devil in his peace. Stop living on your bleeding knees. The way to surrender. Close your eyes, learn to breathe. The oceans are just a few thoughts deep. Believe me, not in me. The messenger is really worth it. If you want a trip, go inside. The secrets of the universe hide. You won't go where you please. Kick the devil in his beat. You don't have to live on your knees. Always sets a track. Feels better every time to know we are all divine. Come back and dream in my street. Do what you want, go where you please. Keep the devil in his peace. Stop living.
Because of Suraj, you started writing.
Right, he pushed your us own actually, music. Yeah, yeah.
And maybe because he's like the lyric writer, very into songwriting.
Right. So right. He always wanted to get into, like, you know, our own songs and take it from there rather than being a cover band.
Was it hard to get shows once you became like the original band?
Yeah, actually, it was, you know, if you think about those times, it was suicidal to play our own songs and get gigs, you know, so
because nobody would care.
Yeah, nobody would care. Because, you know, a band is called in for, like, the organizers, they want to hear their favorite songs being played, you know, so that was the scene at that point.
Yeah.
But we followed these guys, Thermal and a Quarter, because they were like, you know, we won't play any covers. whatever it is, but we are not going to play any covers. So we thought, you know, so then, yeah, why don't we, you know, try that out, you know, let's see where it goes. But we, surprisingly, people started calling us for gigs. So that was like a huge surprise at that point. My God. So then it began, you know, we began to, we started taking off and, you know, and there was one guy called Rahul Gandhi, who was an IAM student at that point. Okay. So he just, you know, mailed us and, you know, I would like to manage you guys. He being a management student,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So you guys don't belong, you know, to this place where I'm taking you guys to North India and all these places where the action is, and, you know.
So you were playing mainly in Kerala at that point?
Yeah, I think the only outstation gig we did was in Chennai at that point.
Yeah.
2002, I'm talking about 2003 that point, you know. So then he pitched us right at IIT Delhi, you know, which had one of the biggest festivals in India at that point. And then it, like, we just took off. You know?
And did people, like, did they find out about you through the music you recorded, like Insane Biography, the first album, or through playing these shows? Did they find out more about you?
I think the concerts.
The concerts.
Because this is the era before YouTube and, you know, all that stuff. And the only, you know, window would be RSJ, because RSJ,
Rock Street Journal
is the only magazine
right
in India which, like, focused on Indian rock.
Yeah,
so they would publish a compilation of bands every year.
Okay.
For the Great Indian Rock.
Yeah.
So that was the only window, and this CD, there will be one CD with the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So that featured Mindstreet. So that's how the people started noticing us, like, you know, there's a band from South and all that.
Did you choose Mindstreet or?
No, they chose
Mindstreet. It was the popular.
Yeah, right. Still so the popular. I think that's the only track we had recorded at that point. No, this and Disillusioned.
Disillusioned, yeah. Okay.
So then they took it and like that. So then it all
that's so funny that Mind Street, I can't believe it was written in such a short span of time,
right?
Because it really was a vehicle for you guys to take off.
Absolutely.
That song, absolutely, like, as soon as it starts, like, really hits home. And I wonder how an outside audience would interpret it, because I don't know if it's something deep in my Indian DNA or because of you were playing it for Indian people.
Right.
But it connected on so many, it really related to people because it was rock, but it was our rock. It was like the people's rock. It was really, like, very, very powerful. I just remember.
Right.
Apparently you used to jam at a restaurant called the Ancient Mariner.
Yeah, Ancient Mariner.
Marine Drive.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's, from 99. We used to jam there.
Was this before the originals?
Actually, that's a place where we scouted Suraj. Because we were playing, at that point, we were only like Baiju. Mithun had left at that point. He left due to some health reasons.
Okay.
And we were Baiju, me, Clyde, and that's it.
Uh-huh.
So we three were jamming there. And then Suraj heard us and came right into the
Really?
Yeah, but we had known him. You know, we used to know him from college days.
Okay.
So then I think a couple of days he came, and then he was like, you know, you guys don't have a vocalist. Okay. Would you like to have me?
Wow.
So then I think I asked him or something. Yeah, I think I asked him, like, you know, would you like to jam with us? And then he was more than happy to get on board. And
nice. And what cover songs did you play? Like, at that, what were the influences?
At that point, we used to play Metallica, Megadeth, Dream Theater and all that.
Nice. And Suraj was into all that stuff as well, right?
No, he was not into that kind of stuff, but he had to, because I was like a tyrant at that point.
the head honcho of Mother Jane. But that's cool. So eventually you moved from getting Suraj, writing original music,
right? Yeah.
Then by some stroke of luck, you wrote a song that connected with every Indian rock person on the scene.
Yeah, everybody.
I just don't know anybody who doesn't know that song.
And before that, we recruited Rex also.
Oh, really?
Rex was like 17 at that point. So
wow.
One of our, you know, I think I met him at Joseph's place, you know, that guitar shop. So
oh, yeah.
He came there, I don't know, he came with his parents and started ripping it apart. So I was like, who's this guy? He's a kid out of town.
Wow.
So then I noticed him, and then I think we were lefted by only Baiju. Mithun left at that point.
Okay.
So then we had to have a guitarist, and then somebody else told me that I know this guy. You know, you've already seen him.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll call him, and you know, you guys talk to his parents and, you know, get it done. So
wow. He was 17?
He was like waiting for a chance. He's like, oh yeah,
my God. That's so good. And for everybody who is listening who doesn't know, Rex is an amazing guitarist.
Absolutely.
And now he's like the best producer in the country, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
He's just amazing production on all the music that he's ever produced. So.
And he has played keyboards also on Insane Biography.
Really?
Yeah, on Mind Street, if you notice, there's keyboards. So
he's a multi-instrumentalist.
Yeah.
Really? I thought he was just a guitarist.
He's a multi-instrumentalist. He plays drums also.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so he's one of those guys.
He'll play anything, yeah.
So the role of producer fits him because he understands
because,
everything.
Because, you know, I always, you know, noticed his capabilities because the first record, that was my first recording.
Mm.
I recorded drums for the first time in my life. So I was like completely blown away when, you know, playing with the click was like, how am I going to do it? You know, so it was some miracle that happened that I actually did it. So this guy helped me a lot.
Hmm.
So I was getting so frustrated on the first takes, and then he was like, you know, John, don't worry about the elements outside or whatever is happening. Just, you know, just look at my hand. You know, and he was like giving me this pulse.
So Rex. Then,
yeah, Rex. Actually, I would credit him for making me play on that record.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did he play? Did he play on that record?
Yeah, Rex played on Insane Biography. He left after a year, I guess.
Okay. But
then, yeah.
Wow. Like that's so crazy. I actually didn't know Rex was part of Mother Jane for a while.
Yeah, he was there from 1999 to 2003.
Oh, so a couple of years.
Yeah, 4 years he's been around,
Wow.
We did quite a lot of gigs also with him,
So, okay, so gigs, right? So touring mainly around India, right?
Right, yeah.
And, you know, when you're touring, the most common thing that tends to happen, at least it happens, you know, with my band and every band that I know, is that you start eating junk food and start eating late and you start, you know, drinking and like a lot of bad habits start to get picked up on the road because I don't know if it's the party element of it or just being around your friends or maybe not having access to a place that's open after a gig or something like that, right? So do you know, like, can you just tell me like what the experience was over the years when you're on tour? Like, how do you manage your food and has it changed over the years?
Yeah, so that's one peculiar thing with Mother Jane because, you know, whenever we went, like, you know, to North India, so we used to demand, like, we want rice and curry.
Like in your what's it called? The rider?
Tech rider? Tech rider had this clause, like, the drummer wants fish fry. That is after 2004. Because then when we went out to these places, yes, in these venues, so they would ask me, so how many burgers for you? We don't want any burgers. We want rice and fish curry and all that. And they would actually, they got us stuff.
Wow.
And we were like this peculiar when we demanded fish, I mean, rice and you know, if it's South Indian, then give it to us. And then we would be speaking Malayalam on stage, as in Malayalam.
Really?
So we were like one peculiar band. Where are these guys from?
So that's really cool that you were able, like, I guess, yeah, 2004 actually, onwards?
Right. Whenever we were touring, we demanded South Indian food. And you won't believe this, that we toured Ukraine. And the organizers had to get us Indian food. And then we were like, you know, trying to figure out where is the Indian restaurant.
Oh, my God. Really?
So, you know, we didn't have our share of junk food. As other
so you
bands,
skipped that, you know, whole...
Yeah, we skipped that whole thing.
That's very, very lucky. And it's because, like, you believe in eating healthy and organic and...
Yeah, that came afterwards.
Okay.
When I got into this organic bandwagon. But even before that, you know, we... Apart from the usual, you know, booze and whatever, smoking up and all that.
Yeah.
But is it okay if I...
Yeah. Oh, this is a very free show. Yeah.
So, you know, food-wise, we were sticking to South Indian food, which is, again, very healthy compared to, you know, it's less fatty and all you know, compared to...
So just because you like the food, not because of any kind of...
Yeah, right.
And you liked it? And it just happened to be healthy.
It just happened, yeah.
Oh, then you're very lucky. Because I remember whenever we
never gave into temptation. Because I was never tempted also to eat junk food, you know.
Really?
Like, oh shit, I don't want junk food, you know.
Oh, that's so interesting. Is it, you were not tempted because it wasn't around? Or you just didn't feel?
But, you know, I think I never had junk food when I was a kid. I think the only junk food I had was Chinese food. Which was, again, like, you know, Indian Chinese.
Right.
It's like spicy as hell and all that. So, you know, so I never got hooked to junk food.
Wow.
And still I don't prefer junk food.
Oh, it's very, very good. And the rest of the band was like this as well?
Yeah, all of us were like that.
Just very happy with...
Yeah, fish fry, rice. Which is the staple in South India, and Kerala, if you ask.
Yes, that's true. Kerala is very well known for fish.
Yeah.
So, and you fry it, I guess, in some oil.
Coconut oil.
Coconut oil, yes. Very, very, very tasty. And was there one particular place where you remember, like, wow, the food is so good when you were touring?
Yeah, I think the places where... We indulged in food were like Calcutta, Hyderabad, and Mumbai.
Those three?
Yeah.
What was different about those?
I think it's a little similar to Australia. Mumbai is like everything. You get everything there.
Okay.
You know? But Hyderabad also, it's like spicy. As Kerala, you know, it's very spicy, over-the-top spicy at some point, you know. And Calcutta also, you know, so... Those places we really indulged in, like, you know.
So whenever you toured there, it was like, we're going to get good,
like,
food.
That, yeah.
And so then this is, I don't know if this question is very valid then, because, you know, the typical scenario is the bands go on tour and they eat like shit. Yeah. And then they come home and then they're like, okay, now we can have home cooked food. But like, what was the difference on the road and off the road?
Right. In India, I think we have enough choices. Unlike abroad, like, you know, you'll get rice at any place, you know. Wherever you travel in India, you'll get rice. And the thing is, there will be a Mallu restaurant somewhere.
Really?
So it's like that, you know. So you
there'll always be a Kerala into, style
right,
restaurant.
Right, right, yeah.
Wow.
Or something similar to it, you know.
Really?
Otherwise, I think we were like, you know, we hunted down those places where you get stuff, you know.
Yeah. I wonder, yeah, that's very, because like, I don't know if it's the choices, but like there's a lot of choices in the US, but the majority of it is, well, the majority of it that's affordable for bands on the road who are already spending money to, drive and gas.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
The only other options you have are like McDonald's, you know, Subway. Subway's relatively better, I guess, but I think that's the trap that we fall into. Any kind of healthy place would be a little overpriced.
Yeah, correct.
And we're already trying to save as much as possible. So that's actually good. It's very cool that India has a lot of options.
Yeah, India has options. And, you know, when we used to, we used to go for competitions, formative years.
Like Battle of the Bands.
Yeah. So we had to stay at friends' places, then Baiju would cook. There are instances where he'll cook, so I will buy him all the stuff. And
Baiju being the guitarist at the time. Yeah.
Even when we produced Clay Play, so we were all we went into Nitin's flat and then we were doing stuff there. Most of the recordings were happening there. So there also I learned cooking because, we ran out of money buying food. Then I learned cooking, YouTube being the biggest guru. Yeah.
Wow. That being said, Clay Play is probably one of my favorite songs.
Thanks, man.
Because I just remember when I saw it, because what was the time span between you released Maktub in 2008?
Right.
And then there was a few singles after that.
Yeah, a few singles in between. And 2014, we started working on Clay Play and we released it in 15.
Before Clay Play, what was the single?
There was one single called No Contest. That was 2011.
That was a while ago.
Yeah, 3-4 years gap.
Yeah. I just remember because Clay Play was a new lineup, right? It was Vivek on vocals.
Yeah, Vivek on vocals and Nitin
on guitar.
Nitin on guitars, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I think, I don't remember if I knew the lineup first. Somebody told me the lineup had changed. So I think a lot of people were speculating that it was going to be a completely different sound. And a lot of people were worried, right? But I remember when I heard that, it was a different sound, but it was so fucking cool. I love that song and the whole video so much. The video is, I think, really, really well-told story. And I think maybe because of the journey both of us are on in the music industry, that video really connected with me.
Thanks.
Just brilliant song.
Full credits to Rex for that,
Oh, he produced that?
Yeah, he produced that.
Very cool. Yeah, so that's weird. He was part of the very first album.
Right. He was in between also, there was one single called Jihad.
Yes.
Which was also produced by...
Oh, interesting.
outside the banks of heaven. Wonder if I'll ever wanna belong to in your by world. Sometimes around me to reach for that way. I've seen faith in action, joy of each other. What's all I miss, pick either bone arrow. Mock warriors like that be one myself. For thus I was led, but I no longer follow.
Kind of relates to what I was talking about, where as the lineup changed, the sound changed,
right?
Yeah, and it's become something else. But I wonder how, like, in your words, how would you put it? Because your experience is different from a fan experience.
Correct.
So, like, over the years, what do you think has changed and evolved with Mother Jane?
I think, you know, every player will bring his own influences and, you know, his style into the band. Right. So we were always open to that. Mm. We never told him that, you know, you have to play it like this or in a specific way.
Right.
Like, you know, you have to follow the band's, like, you know, sound and all that. So we always told them, you know, you play what you want to play and what makes you happy, you know. So,
right.
But, you know, you have to look at this band from a, you know, from an insider's perspective. So, you know, then they started putting in their stuff. So,
and as long as everybody was happy with the sound,
right,
it's it works.
Absolutely.
That's cool, because I think when you've had such a success with Insane Biography and Maktub and all,
correct,
it's very tempting to just say, oh, we should probably try to
stick to that
kind of
style. Right. Yeah,
but it wasn't ever a thought.
It was never there because, you know. But in between, we tried to deviate from the Indian, you know, ethnic elements that we had. But again, we thought that, you know, that makes us the band that we are, you know. So
right.
So we should stick to that thing. But, you know, you can bring in as many elements as we want. But,
right.
You know, stick to that particular
So there's
aspect,
still, the core, there's still Indian and rock.
Absolutely.
But the way it's, I guess, delivered through the new musicians.
Right, yeah.
It kind of paints a different picture.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's really cool. And let's see. Okay, so Namaste is the latest one, right? That's
right,
the one we worked on here at Jam Music Conservatory.
Absolutely.
And Rex, again, produced that.
He produced that track.
So, just to be clear, we recorded the drums at Jam, but everything else was done with Rex, right?
Right.
Guitars, bass, vocals, everything.
Everything.
Yeah. And the vocalist is
Niranj.
So it's a new vocalist, right?
He's a new vocalist, yes.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. So Namaste did very well, right? Went to number one on the iTunes Rock charts. Absolutely, yeah. In India. It's fantastic. And like, is this again the whole natural progression as the singer changes, you know, the style changes, something like that?
Right, yeah. And this song was done with the, like, you know, when Vivek was around. Actually, that was Vivek's tune. And
Vivek
then,
being the previous singer for Clay.
The previous singer. So, you know, that was his tune. And Niranj was like a big fan of this tune.
Uh-huh.
So we had already shelved the song and, you know, we'll work on, you know, maybe other stuff and shelve this song. But he was like, you know, we have to release this tune. You know, I think. And then I thought, like, you know, if you are so confident about it, then let's go and, you know, release it.
And it did well.
So that's how it happened, you know. So
yeah, it did well. It was a very good song. And I really loved the video concept. Who did that?
Yeah, actually, that was, you know, the formative idea came from Paul, my brother, who did all the artwork and logo for Mother Jane. So he, you know, was asking me, why don't you collaborate with another artist, you know, and focus on them rather than on the regular band playing thing, and all that, you know. And then my wife was already connected to these dancers. So she called them up and then they were so excited to, you know, collaborate with us. And that's how it happened. You know?
Wow, interesting. Yeah. That's really cool. And that was released last year?
Yeah, 2018.
18.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah, it was also got really good response, I remember, just from my friends hearing it around. I think, so let's see, 96 it starts, you know, as a cover band.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Then around early 2000s, original music starts to come.
Right. Yeah.
You record your first album. And the song that was written in 30 minutes, Mind Street, just instantly blows up. Everybody loves it.
Right.
It's just like, it's crazy how much that connected with a lot of people. Like, to have that, you know, in your portfolio is like really, really great thing. Then through Maktub, lineup changes, Clay Play, and Namaste. And so what's next for the band? Like, where do you see this going after 22 years?
Yes,
23
yes,
years.
Yes.
It's amazing.
23 years. I think it's just, you know, this 26th, we'll be 23 years old, actually.
That's crazy. It's fine. You can turn it off. 23 years old?
23 years old, yeah. So wow. That's the scene. So we've been working on, like, 3 songs, mm-hmm. and which will be cut into a record, like it will be an EP right now. Yeah, so waiting to record it, you know. So that's the scene.
Because you just had chicken pie.
Yes.
3 songs. Do you know when you're releasing it?
No idea. I think by mid of this year we'll be very good. Releasing it. And maybe before that, you know.
And doing some shows.
Yeah, we have already spoke to a lot of people, like, you know, to support this record. We'll be touring, yes.
Wow.
Yes, yes.
In India?
In India.
Very nice. Wow, that's cool. And is it just, I mean, the natural, like, do you just keep doing it, and like, while it's fun? Or do you have, like, okay, so this year we'll do an EP and tour, the next year we'll do... And then 5 years later, we'll do a...
I tried to take it that corporate way, but it's not happening. So I had some experiences where I learned that, you know, it's not happening with this band, I guess. So we are taking it as it comes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and certain fans from Brazil was like asking us, you know, aren't they not aware of home studio concept? Why are they taking so much, you know, so long between songs and all that? So I think, you know, there are, you know, this lineup changes again will delay things a bit. Happened was before Namaste itself, we had a minor change, so... But after that, I think things are speeding up a bit. So let's see. So we'll release this EP. And we want to continue making songs and, you know, make and be a little more like, you know, fast in delivering goods. But let's see. Let's see.
But yeah, I guess the quality is still important.
That's also very important. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And
can't compromise on that for frequent releases.
Exactly.
It's pointless at this point.
Exactly. I agree. And the fan response is still strong.
Yeah, fans are also, like, you know, fans are following it because of this brand name we made all this year. So fans are still looking forward to stuff.
Yeah.
But we are also planning something, like, you know, away from the normal format. So, you know, like, talking about stuff that normally a band won't do, and you know, so let's see how it comes across. Yeah,
I think because I don't know if it's because of Mind Street or because of the time where you guys are playing, but I think because you built such a strong foundation,
like, right. It happened on its own.
It happened on its own.
Yeah, it's not intentional. Actually, it happened at that point. There were not many bands who did own stuff, or like, you know, so the time
especially
was also
in South
right.
India,
South India, North India also, not many bands who, who took the courage to come up with their own stuff.
Right. It's, wow. Yeah. I think because you have that strong, like, foundation of fans, I think you can just keep going, doing it.
Let's see,
for as long
inshallah.
I really think so. I don't, there's just something about that particular song at that particular time that has kind of, it just opened the minds of a lot of younger musicians here. So it really just kind of inspired everybody. So, and again, it was like, Mother Jane was like one of the few bands that was like touring. Like, we didn't even know that was a possibility to do something like that.
But India has a lot of, you know, a lot of possibilities in that area, because the country is it's like a continent, if you take it, you know. So there's a lot of concerts happening these days. A lot of international bands are touring and they are coming in. I think last week Tesseract
was here,
played
in
Bangalore. So.
Right.
And people like that experience also, so, you know, and a lot of festivals. I think if you take like 2008 or something, the number of festivals, it's like 3 times
more. That's good
now, you know, than the last 10 years. So
that's good.
So the scene is really getting thick here.
A lot more original music is
right kind of, and the Indian bands are being followed more, and you look at Asia, you know, at large, it's there is so much action in Asia right now.
So,
apart from Japan, because Japan was the thing at
of course
some time back, but now all these Asian countries like Vietnam, China, and Indonesia, we have toured Indonesia also.
Jakarta. Yeah, I noticed that Indonesia has a big rock fan base.
Absolutely. I think that's where we played to crowds over 80,000 and all. Because we opened for Mr. Big in 2008, 10 years back. So we got their audience.
That's amazing. But Indian scene, I think it probably is slowly coming
right,
up.
Right. It's coming up. It's coming up in a big way. So
that's good.
It's the same.
Well, I wish you luck for all the things to come.
Thank you.
Looking forward to the new songs, of course. As a fan, just like waiting.
hopefully,
if, you know, if there's any way to break Mother Jane into, like, you know, Brooklyn or, like, you know, America, that'd be so cool.
Just why not?
Why not, right? It's time for new music over there. Cool. All right. Thank you.
We talk about food. About music with musical dudes, finger on the
pulse, snacky tunes. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.